I've had a lot of coffee, and this one stands out. It's called Larry's Coffee. It has this really cute vibe to it, first of all. I've been drinking it in the mornings, and it's noticeably smoother. My favorite blend is Bean Martin. It just tasted so good. I immediately went and got a second cup of coffee. I just love the rich, dark flavor. It's got a little cartoon character on the bag, and he is drinking coffee, and he also has a martini because it's probably an espresso martini because, you know, he's Bean Martin. They have light, medium, dark roast, espresso, decaf. Larry's Coffee is independent, family-owned and operated, roasted in Raleigh, North Carolina for over 30 years. You can try this wonderful coffee and support the BGS Podcast Network at larryscoffee.com/BGS. Listeners of the BGS Podcast Network get a free gift with purchase when they purchase through that show link. And again, that's larryscoffee.com/BGS.
We were sharing a dressing room at the CMA Award, and my tour manager forgot to come and get me out of the audience to change my clothes for my number that I was performing. And it was chaos because I had to change everything down to the pantyhose. He didn't get me out until it went to commercial break. I just realized, and I had on a long dress that had a slit all the way up the front.
Did he get fired?
We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane, the hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life lived in the in-between. Today, we're featuring our conversation with Grammy-winning, platinum-selling singer and songwriter Susie Boggess, who, after 12 years on major labels, went the way of starting her own label and going completely independent in 2004, long before that was even a thing that people were doing, and who, 40-plus years into her career, just this past January, was inducted as a member of the Grand Ole Opry by her close pal, Reba McEntire.
Yeah, and Susie has had such an incredible career and played with everyone from Alison Krauss, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Kathy Mattea, Chet Atkins, Trisha Yearwood, the list goes on. And this conversation really focuses, if we could name one theme, quality over quantity. Mm-hmm. She talks a lot about the value of community as well as the absolute vital need to nurture that connection and love with your fans. It's a really beautiful conversation.
Here's our chat with Susie Boggess.
We like to start with not just the nicety, but the real, how are you today? And where are you physically and creatively?
Well, I am at home today. Mm-hmm. And I'm coming off of about 4 months of just chaos. And so the last 2 weeks, I've been here just, you know, we had a big ice storm. Mm-hmm. So I came home after being down in Florida for 2 weeks at Gretchen Peters' house with Barry Walsh and was down there writing with those guys. And then we came home. Our power had been out for 11 days.
Oh my gosh.
So the day that I got into the house, because the first day we got back, we still didn't have power. So we stayed in a hotel. The next day, I was to start one of the performance classes that I teach. So first, I cleaned out the refrigerator and the freezer, and it was a disgusting job.
Oh, yeah.
Let me just tell you. And then after getting rid of all that nasty stuff and trying to somehow sanitize my refrigerator, mm-hmm. I went to a dinner with my new students and met the 12 people that I was going to be working with for the next 3 days. So, yeah. So it's just kind of been a little nutty because I've just jumped from one thing to another. I knew that I had sort of a busy season because I did a Christmas tour. I hosted my family here at my house after my Christmas tour ended on the 20th and had them for Christmas. And I knew that I was leaving directly after that to go to Steamboat Springs to do a music fest. But in October, I got surprised with the honor of being inducted into the the Grand Ole Opry as a member. And so a lot of preparation goes into that. And I actually had 39 cousins come into town.
Wow. Oh my God.
I had all of my college roomies. Mm-hmm. I had a plethora of old bandmates. So the day after the induction, over 200 people that were friends and family and longtime fans came to a party that was given after the Opry, at the Opry. And then the next day I hosted 70 people at my house where I cooked giant big pot of soup. And then I got catered a bunch of other stuff. But that was with my cousins and my roommates and old bandmates and that sort of thing at the house. The next day I got to be with my roomies for a while, which was great because we just took up from where we left off. Mm-hmm. And then, and then we had one day to pack and left with all of our recording equipment and drove down to Florida for 2 weeks to be with Matresa Berg and Jeff Hanna, Barry and Gretchen. So it had been crazy. And I was really looking forward to just getting down there and chilling out. We were going to write some songs and record some, which we did. But the chill factor was not good because after the third day we were there, the ice storm hit and all the leading up to it was kind of intense too, because we'd left our house alone and it was pretty heavy. And then while we were down there, every single one of us had some kind of water issue in the house, and either neighbors or friends were checking into what was going on at our houses. It was not as immersive as I wanted it to be. I was looking forward to that. I've never in my life had 2 whole weeks with really good friends that were also people that I collaborate with and know really intensely, to just like really try to work on a project like that. And I had been really, really anticipating just the whole immersion of being in that.
Yeah.
Which we still just had the best time in the wide world, but we didn't get as much project done as we would have liked. We got 4 songs and I'm not complaining. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Is that writing that you guys plan to do and recording is for like a specific project, or is it like, let's just write and see what happens and what happens with the songs?
That was exactly it. The idea was no pressure, only let's just do this for fun. You know, a lot of the time that we spent down there, we cooked for each other. Everybody took a turn of doing something cooking, except for Jeff. He's not really a cook kind of guy, but he's a great cleanup dude.
Yeah.
And there you go.
He's very entertaining. So, I mean, he has value in other ways.
Yeah. What an insane crew.
It's so an insane, talented, really intelligent group that I, you know, we were a pod during the COVID times.
Okay.
And so we had worked out all these ways to get together where we were outside, and we made it so that we had something going on, like either a Zoom call or an outdoor gathering, even if it was winter and we had to go to somebody's house who had an outdoor fire. Whatever we could do to just stay sane during that time, because there was so much just not knowing, you know, just not knowing what was going on and what our path was going to be with our careers. If, you know, we had to postpone so many gigs, and everybody went through that. I know everybody in our business went through that, wondering. I'm sure my booking agent was probably going, holy, what do I do now?
Yeah.
You know, I do bookings. I am not making any money.
Yeah.
So for everybody, it was kind of a crazy time.
Just for the audience who's not aware of who we were talking about, but that you were with Matresa Berg, who's a legendary award-winning songwriter, wrote hits like Strawberry Wine. Her husband, Jeff Hanna, who's a Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, like legend.
Founding member.
Yeah, founding member. Gretchen Peters, who has been on this podcast. I mean, it's just like a house full of legends.
Yes. And Barry.
And Barry Walsh, her husband.
Yeah, he has played with every amazing artist, you know, and can play many different styles. Mm-hmm. Everything from, you know, like Four Tops to Waylon Jennings.
Mm-hmm. So, and you guys, I would assume, like, how far back does all of your guys' relationships go? And like, creatively, has it been mostly personal, professional? What's that intermingling?
Yeah, I think I started writing with Matresa and Gretchen probably in 91, something like that. And, you know, we'd been aware of each other before that, but really didn't have a catalyst for a friendship yet until we started writing together. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Jeff was a big part of my, before I came to Nashville. I didn't know him, but when I worked in the ski resorts for about 5 years before I moved to Nashville, I always played the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band on my breaks, you know, mm-hmm. So it was a pretty weird thing for me. I think the first time I went to Matreza's house to write, and all of a sudden, Jeff Hanna popped his head in the door, and I was just, I mean, they were just going together at that time. They weren't married yet. And I just remember going, oh my God, that was Jeff Hanna. All of a sudden, yeah. My Midwestern accent came out. I was like, oh, for Pete's sake, wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
So, and you know, it was a process of getting to know each other because I have a very different personality than Matreza or than Gretchen. But we together, now we understand each other so much and we know each other. And yeah, I think originally Matreza used to have such a thing thinking that I was like, just so nice and such a nice girl from the Midwest, you know, and eventually she realized that I'm just rotten, which now she really appreciates that side of me because I am totally rotten. And I embarrass them constantly. You know, we ended up doing 3 different tours in the UK together as a group called Wine, Women, and Song. Mm-hmm. And each tour, we, you know, got a little bit longer and a little bit more in depth. And we played some wonderful things, including Glastonbury. And every time, you know, we got closer as friends and really understood each other and really got good at being around each other and knowing when it was time to walk away or to, you know, just take a break from something because, you know, we're just different people. I mean, each one of us, though, has a little bit of an extrovert and a little bit of introvert. And unfortunately, I have much more of the extrovert than they do. So I know when I'm on their nerves, I know that, you know, I'm just like the little puppy dog that's going, hey, guys, you want to do something? Hey, let's go do something.
I love that. I feel like that's sometimes my dynamic. I'm like, I don't quite know when to turn it off sometimes. It's changed now that the exhaustion of parenthood, we have 2 young children. So that's different. But I was on tour last year, 6 months pregnant, and my girlfriend that I brought to play keys and guitar with me, like at the end of the night, I'd be so amped up and it'd be like midnight and I'd be like, let's go dancing. And she was like, you are 6 months pregnant. We need quiet time.
You need to go to bed. Yeah. I know. Oh gosh. I know what it feels like. You know, it's like you're out there, there's no drinking. So you're, you know, like, and you feel good at that point, you know, you're like got extra energy. You got them prenatal vitamins in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, just the adrenaline from a show, and I get energy from talking to people, so I would sell my own merch, and I would feel so energized afterwards, and she would be like, you're going to be throwing up in the morning because I threw up my entire pregnancy. She was like, let's go. Yeah. But I highlight, it's, you know, one of the things we talk a lot about on this podcast is the value of community, especially in an industry that can feel, especially among women, that can breed competition, and how important it is to really have relationships with our professional peers that then turn into real friendships. And so that's just extraordinary that you guys have been friends and collaborators for so long and still have that.
Yeah. And, you know, now I have a new group of people that I've been getting to know better. People that were like really strong peers of mine during that time when we really were kind of pitted against each other. I don't think that it was a malicious kind of thing, but the labels could not help but want to keep us from being too close because there were times when there was singles coming out that were going to, you know, come out and be on top of somebody's or whatever. So, you know, now I've got another group of gals, and oddly, that we call ourselves Nashville Girls because it's Terry Clark who cut a song called Nashville Girls that Gretchen and Matreza wrote. So, yeah, it's just has come full circle. So like Reba and Trisha and Terry and Pam Tillis, we had all kind of been touring together. And now Kathy Mattea, I worked with her. Mm-hmm. I've been friends with Kathy, like sisters, for 30 some years. But this new group, we just brought Wynonna in. And it's really just been like kind of, there's so many great stories. And sometimes we get bitter and mean and it's funny. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we cry and, you know, have actual breakdowns about some of the things that we tend to sacrifice in the business. You know, it's like it's not always an easy decision to make to tour, and, you know, especially when you got kids and lots of just hard decisions, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really good. It's been good for all of us when something great happens to one of us to just have a little text thread that says, I just saw this, and that's so cool that that happened for you. Mm-hmm. There's something about having your cheerleader friends pat you on the back for whatever accomplishment, or just knowing something that is hard that you just had to hustle through, mm-hmm. and have them just go, you're my hero. You know, mm-hmm. that's a really great feeling. And so many of us during that late 80s, early 90s, time period, you know, we just didn't have time to even have friendships because we were out on separate tours, and it was pretty unheard of for a girl to tour with another girl.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we were mostly out there with the dudes, and that's why most of us talk like sailors.
Yeah.
Michaela included.
Yeah. Yeah, that's hard when you're a mom. It's like you had to like really like temper it. And I noticed that once my son turned about 15, that it was okay for me to bring it back.
We haven't tempered it in our 4-year-old.
We've taken the course of just being like, these are adult words. If you use them in public, you might offend somebody. Somebody might get upset. You might get in trouble. So
yeah.
Use these at home. And I'm going to knock on wood. Like, it's pretty incredible.
But I definitely am like, oh no, when I hear her, because she'll use it sometimes. And we remind her, we're not just like, it's not a free for all, but we're just like, hey, Georgia, that's not, you know, that's a grown up word. But she will use it. And I'm like, oh, she's totally parroting me, because she'll be like, Jesus Christ. And I'm like, yeah. Or she looked at her baby brother, who was like 4 months at the time. They were like both in the car waiting to go somewhere. And she goes, it's fucking hot, right, Henry?
Oh, my God. Oh, man. Well, you know, mine was the opposite. You know, like, I didn't even let him watch Rugrats. I just didn't want him to be mean. Mm-hmm. Didn't want him to be a mean kid. And so I can remember him being about 2 or something like that. Probably even younger than that, because he started talking when he was 10 months.
Oh, wow.
And believe me, this boy can talk.
Yeah.
So he's like really young. I don't know what happened, but he's at the dinner table. He just out of the blue, he says, you say damn it. I know say damn it. Right, mommy? I said, right. I say damn it. You know say damn it.
Exactly. You got it.
And then we read one of the first runs before we started Wine, Women, and Song, which was Gretchen and Matrice and I's little band that we took to the UK. We went over to just do Celtic Connections over there. Mm-hmm. And Ben was 11 at the time. And I took him, and Barry and Jeff went, because my husband Doug was working for Yamaha at the time, so he couldn't go. So Ben came, because I'm a steward. My mom was a steward. And I wanted to take him to Edinburgh, to the castle, and do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we're gone for like 8 days or something. We're back in the airport in Chicago, and we, you know, we're waiting for our next plane or whatever. And everybody's like, oh, Ben, we're going to really miss being with you. It was a lot of fun having you along, you know, and everything. And he looks at Gretchen, he goes, Gretchen, you sure cuss a lot. She said, yeah, I do. Because,
yeah.
I mean, because she was like that with James, I think. She's very open. And I played the Midwestern Donna Reed mommy, you know, like I was like, I want everything to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And he turned out perfect, but absolutely wonderfully unrefined. Thank God.
Yeah. Perfectly imperfect.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
Hey, just a quick pause from this conversation. The Other 22 Hours is an independent production built entirely on the idea that these quiet, honest conversations matter. The best way to support our work is simply to share it. So if you can think of one person who would appreciate this show, please pass it along. And if you haven't yet, please follow our show on your listening platform of choice or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's a small action that makes a massive difference for us. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation.
Well, I mean, there's so many things I'd love to talk to you about, but I'm so curious about, especially the women also that you just mentioned in your other text group is like, to me, as someone who grew up as a child of the 90s, like, you guys are the royalty of pop country. And in recent years, women in country music has been such a hot button topic. And I'm really curious to hear from your perspective what it was like to be really on the inside of that and kind of in the heyday of when there were so many women getting played. And even as you mentioned, like, maybe there was pitting against each other, but there were so many women. And in the last 10 plus years, it's been like, what, there's maybe allowed to be one or two on the charts of, you know, 100 dudes.
Isn't that just so wild? It's mind-boggling that it stepped back in time. It just didn't make any sense. I mean, honestly, I thought the world of all those ladies and Lori Morgan. And I mean, just so many other artists that were out there at the same time. Patti Loveless, I mean, and Patti and Faith and I got to do a few dates together. Mary Chapin Carpenter and Kathy and I got to do a few dates together. But it was very rare that we would get to actually work together. And I did a tour, a different tour in the UK, and it was Trisha and Alison Krauss and I. And back when I won the Horizon Award, and it was 1992, and the labels had pitted Trisha and I against each other. And their camp was doing a book about Trisha and her rise and that sort of thing. And I came out as this awful, horrible person that was really mean to her in this book. And I believed that she thought that was the case, but she didn't write it. She didn't write that stuff. And the fact was, is it came from an incident where we were sharing a dressing room at the CMA Award that same night. And my tour manager forgot to come and get me out of the audience to change my clothes for my number that I was performing. And it was chaos because I had to change everything down to the pantyhose. And I had lace-up boots, a hat, a belt, different underwear, everything. And he didn't get me out until it went to commercial break. I just realized, and I had on a long dress that had a slit all the way up the front.
Did he get fired?
Well, see, I just freaked out. And so I went into the dressing room and I was just bitching and just screaming and angry and fucking this and all that, you know, like angry. And I think that this person was in that room when they saw me doing that and didn't have a clue of what was going on for me. And then I had to run out there and do that. I mean, if I would have had to do Outbound Plane in that long dress, it would have been ridiculous. And so I, you know, pulled it off at the last second. I mean, right before I had to jump on stage, I had slapped my hat on my head and just got out there and did it. Anyway, when we did this little run in the UK, Alison and Trisha and I shared a dressing room, and I expressed that to her, that I felt like somehow it had gotten to her that I didn't love what she does, because I am such a big fan of both of theirs. And so we ended up working up a tune for the last program that we did. And we picked one of the trio songs. We did Farther Along together, you know, and then they came back to the States and sang on my next album. So, I mean, it just, there's some things that just have to work out through time, you know, and the history might not actually be reality. And there were also times, there were times when I would be trying to hire somebody to promote a record, a single or something, aside from my record label. And they would say, oh, I can't take you because I have a Patti Loveless record. And I'd be like, but you got eight guys that you're working right now. So what is the difference? You can only do one girl. And that, I think, is what happens to this day, is that they still don't want to believe that women can have an audience, and we do. And they're really loyal. It's kind of great in a way, because now that so many of us have become friends and it's obvious, we have crossover fans too. And so that's a beautiful thing. It really helps everybody, because you know, we're not all touring at the same time. And, you know, when I went out with Pam and Terry for a while, God, I mean, it was the best time in the whole wide world. I mean, the mornings, Pam Till is entertaining us with her funny stories of all the many years since she was 7 years old being in the music business, you know, and at nighttime, you know, her dancing around like a little old man in her bunny pajamas, you know. If you ever follow her and Lori Morgan out on the road, you will see some of the funniest stuff because they just have fun. It's, I mean, that's the thing. And Terry, of course, you know, we would just laugh at her because it's like Pam and I would still be scooping up everything in our dressing room, you know, like just have a clothes bomb go off in there as soon as we got there. And Terry would, you know, like dress on the bus, come in, do the meet and greet. By the time we collected all our crap, Terry would be on a bus, makeup off, in her pajamas, and we'd come on the bus, and she'd already have a glass of wine in her hand.
Yeah.
We'd be like, God, you know, we just got in here, you know, with all our crap. You know, I'd say that, you know, it was because she gets to wear a hat. She didn't have to do her hair, but she still has her hair. Even when she's wearing a hat. I was like, crap.
Yeah, it's so, it has never made sense to me. Like, people have blatantly said to me, like journalists and radio people, like, oh, I loved your record. I wanted to review it, but I just reviewed so-and-so's. And I'm like, what does that have to do with anything?
What does it have to do with anything?
It's said with like a, of course you understand, I can't review two women back to back. And I don't get it because I'm like, as a fan who is a woman, it doesn't like divide my love for the musicians I love. And I love so many women musicians. So it doesn't make sense. But I'm curious, as the years have progressed, I know like you were on Capitol for about 10 years or so. And then you signed an indie label. And then you started your own label early on 2001, if I'm correct.
Yeah, that's about right.
I feel like there's often a progression I see with people, and especially in the place I'm at in my life and career, and some of my peers, of like, I'm more in the Americana world. We've not had like big, you know, mainstream success, but a bunch of us have like signed indie deals, gone through that route, kind of honestly seen like behind the curtain of the pros and cons of that, and then coming through to the side of like, actually, okay, I don't know if I want to play that game, and see the negatives of that, and now doing things our own way independently, coming to terms with like our careers might be smaller than we had envisioned, but how incredible that might still be. And it's all a scale, right? So even if you go from selling 20,000 tickets to 5,000, that still feels like a step back. Can you talk about what that process has been like for you, and also like understanding all the things that are outside of our control, like deeply ingrained sexism?
Yeah. Well, here's one thing. I mean, you just really have to know that things were changing really rapidly, even at the end of my career. And it was obvious that things were going to be changing, and that the record labels were not going to have as much of a catapulting kind of thing. You know, when I came in, we had developmental deals. I mean, it was easy to fall into the abyss. You know, it was easy to have one thing that kind of worked, and then the next thing didn't work. And if the next thing after that didn't work, then it was just, you're over. You know, when I was on Capitol, I was actually on Capitol for 12 years, and it was singles at a time before I did an album. I'd been on the label for 2.5 years by the time I got to do an album. That stuff was changing rapidly. I'm lucky because my husband's a techie and a computer dude, and he saw all the stuff going on. And then Capitol had changed CEOs, head of the label, 4 times from the time that I got signed. And so the fourth guy, I was just like, I cut my hair. I did everything I could do to be new and improved. Lost weight, did everything. But there was no new approval that was going to work with somebody who, it wasn't a music guy. He came from marketing. And so he didn't really get me. And so I kind of knew I was on the way out at that point. And like I say, Doug was really good at saying, you know, stuff is changing really fast. And so it wasn't an easy thing, because you do have to go from doing pretty well, but as my career was already waning, it wasn't like I was getting the major tours and that kind of thing. I was, you know, scurrying for dates, you know. Mm-hmm. I would call my agent at CAA and I'd go, you know, I even went from the top dog at CAA to the kind of a newbie guy. I would call him and I'd go, my calendar looks like a blizzard. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't there be some writing in there of places that I'm going? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I kind of like, I could read the writing. I had a new kid, you know, a young kid, and he was getting ready to start kindergarten like a year later. And I was thinking about how nice it would be to go to school and cut out shapes and put together pipe cleaner stuff and, you know, bring cupcakes, do that whole thing. Because I, you know, I am Susie Homemaker. And, you know, I came up in the camper truck going out and booking my own gigs. And I always knew I had that. I always felt like no matter what, I'm still going to get to play enough that I'm going to feed my soul and get to do what I need to do as far as connecting with people with my music. That's one of the things that I'm hoping that you younger folks are really appreciating about your freedom. We were not allowed to sign after the shows because the rack jobbers wanted people to go to Walmart and buy the CD. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there were a lot of things that kept you from having those relationships with your fans. Mm-hmm. That now with social media, and I know that, you know, there's curses to that as well. Mm-hmm. But there's also a real significant value to one-on-one relationship with your people who appreciate your music. Mm-hmm. And I got that back when I did my folk project. That helped a lot. I was touring with Garrison Keillor and doing some like artsier kind of places. And that's allowed me to play in a lot of smaller theaters and things like that. But then COVID, you know, it was like we all needed each other and I needed those people. You know, I was 30 some years I've been hearing this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I needed something to keep me going and keep practicing and keep my chops up. And when I reached out with my little Wind Down Wednesday thing, it wasn't clapping, but the little hearts, they still gave me happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Little hearts can make you happy. And then eventually, you know, as things started opening up, I'd be able to have a friend over and sit 6 feet away and we would wear a mask except for when we would sing and we would sing in one direction. And then, you know, like one thing after another, it started to be a big deal. And I just felt so invigorated by the audience. And I don't know if you know this, but also during that time, because we did not know when we were going to get back on the road, it was a year and a half that we were home. Mm-hmm. So I also went back to the old school stuff from my folk period in my RV, and I created a little kind of my own Patreon kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I have a group I call the Inner Circle, and it was bigger initially. It's dwindled down to like 150 people, but they pay a $10 fee every month, and I create new content for them. I talk to them in Zoom meetings. They get everything first. And it doesn't matter how small the group is. It matters that you have somebody who's rooting for you and encouraging you to continue making your art. It's like having a patron, you know, it's like they're true patrons to you. And I just feel like that's a very valid way. I mean, it's been going on since Amadeus, you know?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So, I mean, it may become even more prevalent and even more necessary as the government is shutting down more public access to music. And so, I mean, what would you recommend for new artists? And I would say, number one, it's great if you can play an instrument, even if you're not great on it. Just so that you can communicate with the musicians that you're playing with. It makes it easier if you could speak the language with them, if you're a singer, and then cherish those relationships. Emails are gold. And make sure that people keep up with their emails, because when they change them and you don't get it back, they're gold. You need that. And we have that ability then to reach out and say, I'm going to be playing in your area. Please come out and tell your friends. Mm-hmm. And it continues to grow your audience and to keep filling it in my case, because my folks are a little older. Mm-hmm. It used to be that I could just say to everybody, oh, my husband is the white-haired guy. Just look for him. You know, if you need to talk to some, you know, like if a radio personality was going to be there, so I just look for the white-haired guy. Like, now everybody, I go, oh, all right. All right, that's not going to work anymore. He's going to have to start wearing a green tie or something.
Yeah. I think what you were touching on is so important, like the shift from quantity of fans to quality of fans. And I think that's across the board. I think, like, you know, yeah. You have obviously social media, you know, it's great that you can connect with your fans, but it's more or less a pay to play situation where you're controlled by an algorithm that, like, you know, you could have 10,000 followers and 200 see it. And then the same all these streaming services. It's like, you know, you hear these horror stories of, to use Spotify as an example, these Spotify playlists that used to be king and queen makers, where you get on this playlist and all of a sudden you get all these streams. It's like the one person that was sitting in whatever co-working space in East Nashville putting that playlist together is now an algorithm. And that's, you know, there's all this talk about a resurgence of payola and all of that, that it's like, yeah, emails are king. And it's like, you know, I really see that if you can have a quality connection with fans, what they can provide you over the length of a career versus just like getting 8 million people to hear one song and then they never see your name again. It's like, I kind of observed this growing pain in labels too. They don't know how to shift because it's happening for everybody. And, you know, what I see is whatever geographic location makes up Music Row now, they write 3 songs over and over and over again. And there is nothing to me really inspiring coming out of that factory system anymore.
You can't chase that, man. You just can't. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. This is like a sage thing that I heard just a year ago. And I can't tell you how much of a difference it's made for me. Of all the people, it was somebody who very rarely speaks and very rarely does interviews. And it's Alan Jackson. Mm-hmm. You know, he was getting an award or whatever. And they said, does it make you feel good that all these people come to see you? And he said, yeah, of course it does. He says, but the honest truth is they want me to see them. Mm. And I will tell you, this is a strange thing to remember. Realize your fans. Mm-hmm. Give them love. You're giving them all when you give them your art. But when you recognize they have a commonality, otherwise they would not be there to see you and your music. When you see them, it makes a really strong bond. Mm. And it goes on and on and on. I was saying that Opry thing, you know, it's like I had people there that had been following me since I was playing in college. That's my main thing that I feel like the younger artists, you have the ability to do that. But like you say, when everything's random and you, no matter how many dollars you spend to boost an ad or do whatever, you still don't have a clue if it's reaching the people that you have the heart for what you do. Mm-hmm. That's why the one-on-one, one-to-one kind of thing really, really works. And of course, you have to have some boundary at some point because you really have that many friends. And it was really hard to keep up with that many friends.
Yeah.
I can't stress it enough. What comes in my mind is, you know, I started out playing in little places and I still feel like you can go to a coffee shop or whatever, just to get a little groove going with some people that have, there's some traffic there. You know, I used to make like $50 and then tips. Mm-hmm. So if you make $100 a night, that's like a year's worth of streams, guys.
I know.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So go make $100 in a coffee shop and make an audience that you're one-on-one with. Nobody's ever going to take live music away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
People are always going to crave it. They're always going to want to feel it and sit in it. And it's not going to matter what we record. It's going to matter how it moves them when they're there and in the moment with you. So that's my take. And that's the thing that keeps me motivated to keep out on the road and try to stretch my hips out and stuff like I have to do.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Aaron has gotten to play He played with a group that opened for the Chicks. So he's played the bigger stages. The biggest stages I've played are like festivals or like 1,000 or a couple thousand people.
Yeah.
And there is something to be said that like the small rooms can have even more magic.
They're vibey.
Yeah, that sometimes like 100 people, a few hundred people, like that connection, it all kind of goes back to like what your motivation is, what your intention is. And that's been such a beautiful reminder of like, it can be so fulfilling to go play in somebody's living room because it means so much to them. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, it was years ago, I was at Folk Alliance and Kathy Mattea's husband, John Besner, mm-hmm. award-winning songwriter. He was teaching at the camp there and he was also playing. And, you know, at Folk Alliance, there's, for people who don't know, it's this music conference and everybody's playing in hotel rooms. It's really bizarre and and fun.
It really is like camp. You know, it's like going to camp.
Unamplified. People are just playing music while everybody's like sitting on a hotel bed and all the doors are open. And John Vesner, who's won Grammys and stuff, I remember him talking about it and being like, this has to
be a good way to put it,
as fulfilling, because you can get to the top and you might be back here. He's like, I'm here. Like, this has to be as moving and fulfilling if you are going to survive this life as a musician.
That's really smart.
That's really stuck with me for years, because I think that was like 12 years ago, and I got to meet Kathy a couple years ago when I played Mountain Stage when she was hosting, mm-hmm. and had to tell her, because also we don't know when people say little passing comments like that. Those little nuggets of wisdom can just be like nourishment that holds you through, you know, 15 years.
Yeah, exactly true. I mean, that's a really wonderful thing what he said there, because honestly, it's like, what is your motivation? I mean, if your motivation is to do the Paris Hilton Kardashian style, like, I'm famous, well, that's one thing. But if you're out there to share your art and to stay inspired, you've got to get out. You've got to get out and do it. You know, it's really hard to sit in your room and just be inspired to write about the beautiful birds at the bird feeder, you know, whatever, you know, it's. And also sharing time with musicians, there's just nothing better. That's been some of my most fun memories, is just being on the bus with a bunch of people or going to do a workshop or a camp or that kind of thing, where you get to know somebody more in depth. Even if I go out to see somebody play, it inspires me. It kicks me in the butt. It says, oh my God, you're just so complacent lately, you know, get up, you know, be a different kind of rock and then the sedentary.
Yeah. Well, I also have to think about, for me, I have to think about the human reward of all of this and not the things that we're kind of taught to value as like streaming numbers and awards, but really like what fills us as humans. And I often go back to like, what an incredible gift it is to have the experience of creating with friends, like the friendship that we get to experience when we're writing together or making music together. That is so special that the vast majority of people don't get to experience. And regardless of career, like just to be in a room, just to get that opportunity to love someone as a person, as a friend, and then have the bonding experience of knowing each other on this deeper level through writing something or playing, we can so easily take that for granted, because it's like, well, yeah, especially living in Nashville, because everyone does it. It's like, well, this is actually magical.
Yeah. I've got to say, you know, there's been times when I've been kind of curious. It's like, wow, it's like, used to be like three people on a co-write was a really weird thing. You know, two people was much more common in a co-write, and Nashville's very known for its co-writing. But then I started seeing the number of five people on this one. And I have a really good friend named Tori Touillet. And I don't know if you know Tori, but she's a wonderful songwriter. And she worked with me for a few years, helping me learn how to use computers and stuff, because she's young. And it, you know, would always like, I'd always be like, yeah, but you know, can you make anything when you're doing that? But then I'd start realizing that that's not the point. It's the long tail. You know, it's like, you asked me about, you know, when I came out of Capitol after all those years, probably like everybody else, I read all those Who Moved My Cheese and The Lauderdale and all those books, you know, like, let me try to feel better about how this is going to go. And I think that because I came up by booking myself and traveling around a camper truck and knowing how to make my own posters and do all that stuff, it just came kind of natural to me to be able to learn how to do it on the computer and be able to do it through social. But I just feel like that's part of the reason. And maybe that's just my take on it. That maybe that's the reason that people are writing more people together, because it feeds more souls. You're getting together and you have a tribe, a community that you are working together often, and you know, you get kind of a system to it and sort of a routine about how many days you write. And, you know, the more that you put out there, obviously in this climate, the more music you put out there, the more chance you have of something actually lighting a fire somewhere.
Yeah.
So being prolific can be helpful, even if it doesn't mean that every song is going to be, you know, your very best. But practice makes perfect, as they say. So maybe there's something to that too. Just not being so precious about it that you are afraid that it won't live up to something else you've done that was better than that.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my writing is for sync and for placements and stuff. And there are songs, the songs that I've placed that have gotten the biggest fees are ones that were essentially an afterthought. I'm like, you want to use that one? Okay. That one?
Yeah.
What about this
one?
This one took days. This one took like an hour, and you want to use that?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's so true. It's really, I know. And you kind of just have to say, I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth, you know?
Yep.
Yep. Exactly.
I'll have something get on a Amazon or Apple playlist or something like that. I'm just like, oh my God. Yep. Let me tell you about the second verse. It's so bad in the.
Yeah.
I just let it go, man. I just like, I should have gone back.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the song that Rodney wrote?
Shame on the Moon.
Shame on the Moon. We had Rodney Crowell as a guest early in this show.
Oh,
and he was talking about Shame on the Moon.
Uh-huh.
Bob Seger.
Yeah, which Bob Seger recorded and made a hit. And, you know, Rodney was like, it took me 40 years to finish that song. I don't even think it's finished. And he was telling us this story about how someone came up to him and was like trying to jar him a little bit. They're like, Rodney, I really love that song, but you know, like that third verse, just,
they said,
I wish I was in the room with you. And Rodney looks at him and he goes, thank you. And wanted to give him a hug because, you know, even though it had been out forever, Rodney was like, it's still not done.
Oh my God. That's hysterical. Oh my God. So. Yeah.
Oh man.
Well, it's kind of true.
This has been so, I feel like excited.
Yeah.
I'm really glad nourishing.
That we got to talk. Yeah. It was helpful to me too. Yeah, that's what I say. It's like, we've got to be in touch with each other. And I have another interview this afternoon that's going to be like with TV cameras and all that stuff.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Like, I'm glad that you maybe get up extra early so that the bags under my eyes would be just a little lower.
Yeah. You got warmed up.
Yeah. Well, we do like to finish our conversations with asking everybody the same question. And you've provided so many little nuggets already, but it's more in that line. And it's either something that someone has shared with you along the way that continues to resonate and fill your cup, or conversely, something that you wish you knew when you're first getting started in making a career out of your creativity.
Oh, goodness. That little tidbit that Alan I then quoted, that has really rocked my world. And I think that in some ways that was instinctively my feeling that, you know, being artists, we're here to help people sometimes feel their emotions that they don't even know how to do. I'll give you a pithy quote that I got from Chet Atkins.
I love that.
He was always very careful to say that he was not giving me advice ever, but I was doing a show with him. And this is one of my favorite things that he ever said, because he was very dry. And we were on stage and I introduced a song that my husband, Doug Kreider, and Chet and I had written. And I started to introduce it. And he said, and it's a song that Susie and her husband wrote. And I said, and you, because you wrote the music, you know? And I just looked at the audience. I said, he is so modest. And he gets up on the mic and he says, I got a lot to be modest about. and it's my favorite. So
yeah,
remember that. If anybody ever says you're being too modest, just say, well, I got a lot to be modest about.
I love that. Oh my gosh.
So good.
Yeah. Man. So I really enjoyed this, you guys. Let's get a cup of coffee.
Yes.
Let's go do something.
Too.
Please. Yeah.
Keep sharing it with everybody and you're going to keep delighting people. So we'll see you around out there.
Yeah. Sounds thank good. You so much.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
We know your time is valuable and we're grateful you chose to spend this hour with us.
If this conversation resonated with you, know that it is just one of many. We have an archive of over 140 conversations, so if you're looking for where to go to next, you can find curated playlists by topic on our YouTube channel or simply scroll back in this feed to find our conversations with Roseanne Cash, New York Times bestselling author Maggie Smith, Lucius, J.D. McPherson, and many others.
This show is produced by me, Aaron Schaefer-Bates, with help from Michaela Ann. All the music you hear is written, performed, and produced by me as well.
Our show is edited and mixed by Leland Holden at Podpunch, and we are proud members of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.